this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We was able to get them together and sell it. And not only that, we're getting for the United States a lot of the mineral rights from the Congo.
Donald Trump says that he doesn't understand the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but that the U.S. will gain a lot of Congolese mineral rights from the deal.
There is not enough of rank and file power. We have to build that, because in order to take on Amazon's, the UPS's of the world, there has to be more power within the ranks.
Philadelphia Teamster Richard Hooker Jr. on why he is running against Teamster President Sean O'Brien and what to do if there's a coup and martial law in the United States.
We're naming names. We're drawing connections. We're telling folks exactly what it is that they're doing. And we're telling Palantir, hell no, not in our neighborhood, not in our backyards. Yeah.
Protesters charge Palantir with profiting from the mass roundup of immigrants and for providing tech for the genocide in Gaza.
Politically and psychologically, Iran has won this round, and Israel, it's a self-inflicted blow by Israel.
The Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal discussed the U.S. war with Iran with Judge Andrew Napolitano. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo have signed a peace deal brokered by the U.S. in Washington, D.C. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
The foreign ministers of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo sat down with Secretary of State Marco Rubio to sign a peace agreement at the U.S. State Department on Friday, June 27. The agreement is as notable for what it doesn't say as for what it does. Despite stating that the two countries will respect one another's territorial integrity, it does not say that Rwandan troops must withdraw from DRC or even acknowledge that they're there. It does not say that there are no Congolese troops in Rwanda. In June and December 2024, UN investigators reported that thousands of Rwandan troops are in DRC, outnumbering those of the M23 militia, and that Rwandan and M23 militia troops are integrated under Rwandan command. The agreement does not say that M23, which again operates under Rwandan command, will surrender its control of Congo's North and South Kivu provinces. During the military offensive it began last January, M23 seized the capitals of both North and South Kivu provinces and appointed their own governors, effectively putting Rwanda in control. Despite all the evidence that M23 operates with Rwandan troops under Rwandan command, the agreement refers to M23 as though it were distinct from the Rwandan army. It says that M23 and DRC are negotiating their own agreement in Doha. Reporting from Goma, the capital of North Kivu, Al Jazeera reporter Alain Wakani said that the fighting continued even as the peace agreement was being signed, and that Congolese are concerned because the agreement says nothing about M23's withdrawal.
We have to describe how the situation is, and also this deal, you heard clearly that they are not mentioning the M23 rebels and IFC coalition. This rebel movement right now, it's almost a big coalition right now, leading not only a sector or even a territory. They are now in control of the big province like North Kivu here and also South Kivu. They have been appointing governors. They have now airport under their control. And people, by listening or by following this step in the U.S., they were trying to expect and to see what will happen exactly with the rebels on the ground.
The agreement makes only three references to M23, one in the glossary. The other two simply say that the parties will respect ongoing negotiations between AFL-M23 and DRC. It makes 43 references to the FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, a militia of Rwandan refugees and children of refugees who fled into eastern DRC at the end of the Rwandan War and Genocide in 1994. For decades, President Paul Kagame and other Rwandan officials have repeated that the FDLR threatened to return to repeat the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, and that they are the source of all the instability in Congo and the region. Rwandan Foreign Minister Olivier Nduhungirehe repeated Rwanda's mantra at the State Department press conference before the so-called peace agreement was signed.
This is grounded in the commitment made here for an irreversible and verifiable end to state support for FDLR and associated militias. That is the bedrock of peace and security in our region.
The Rwandan narrative flies in the face of decades of well-documented Rwandan aggression. Rwanda invaded DRC with Uganda in 1996 and then again in 1998. According to the 2010 UN mapping report, its army killed tens of thousands of Hutu refugees in what a competent court might rule to be genocide and/or crimes against humanity. 25 years of UN investigations have also documented Rwanda's theft of vast quantities of Congolese minerals and other resources. The agreement makes no mention of these crimes and doesn't even acknowledge the presence of Rwandan troops in the country. It makes only oblique reference to Rwanda's, quote, defensive measures. The so-called peace agreement's singular focus on the FDLR as a source of instability and its representation of Rwanda's actions as, quote, defensive, represents a complete capitulation to Rwanda's narrative. Something else the agreement does not say is that Congo's vast resources belong to the Congolese people, or that the Congolese people should benefit from them. It refers to regional integration and lawful process in vague terms and says that both parties will benefit from, quote, regional critical mineral supply chains. This is understood to mean, for one, that Rwanda will become the region's minerals refining hub, even though it has no significant mineral reserves within its own borders. President Trump told reporters that he was out of his depth regarding the Congo conflict, but that his advisor, Masabulos, is not, and that the U.S. will gain a lot of Congolese mineral rights from the deal.
I'm a little out of my league in that one because I didn't know too much about it. I knew one thing. They were going at it for many years, and with machetes, it is one of the worst wars that anyone's ever seen. And I just happened to have somebody that was able to get it settled. I mean, just a brilliant person who is very comfortable in that part of the world. It's a very dangerous part of the world. I said, are you uncomfortable there? People are being killed. School children are being raided and killed. And I don't even want to say how, but as viciously as I've ever heard. Are you uncomfortable? No, that's the part of the world that I know. Very comfortable. Was able to get them together and sell it. And not only that, we're getting for the United States a lot of the mineral rights from the Congo.
Trump did not say that the Congolese people will benefit by these deals. Despite the country's vast resource wealth, they are among the fifth poorest populations in the world.
That was Pacifica's Anne Garrison on the Rwanda-DRC peace deal.
Promesse le lendemain, promesse de l'aube d'un état souverain où le sol se dérobe entre milices et rebelles, pillages et recels, peuple que l'on déplace comme des cheptels, de parcelle en parcelle, gouvernance en tutelle, état de droit essentiel, à nos ethnies unies au pluriel, effet papillon, effet tampon, car ici on change leur en blanc, la révolution au bout du vote, la force du nombre est l'antidote pour changer la dette en dot. Autant de droits que de devoirs, plus de points de convergence que de différences, et oublier l'État-providence.
Indépendance, cha-cha, faut s'oublier.
Tare Moya Julai.
Indépendance, cha-cha,
Saïm et ses mamas.
Okipanza, cha-cha, Koubaki.
Ça,
Olipanas, cha-cha,
et mes mamas.
Faut s'oublier.
That was Balogi covering Independence Cha-Cha. The crisis in the trade union movement is growing as workers and unions are under direct attack. One of Trump's biggest supporters is Teamsters Union President Sean O'Brien, who gave money to the Republican National Committee and invited Trump to the Teamsters headquarters for a press conference attacking immigrants. Philadelphia Teamster Local 623 Secretary Treasurer Richard Hooker Jr. declared last week that he will be running against O'Brien. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Well, if you look at what's been going on right now within the Teamsters, it's been going on for a very long time. When you talk about the business side of unionism, when you talk about the autocratic, dictatorial aspect of the Teamsters, very, very brutal and retaliatory. That has been the history. And because of that history, the members always suffer. And I know that the Teamsters, we like to talk about and brag about, you know, historic contracts and pensions and healthcare and all these things, which are good, but we could be doing a lot better, especially in this element of Donald Trump and his just attack on the working class. In my opinion, the Teamsters are the strongest arm in the working class. But right now, we have been separated because of the decisions by our general president. He has isolated us from the rest of the working class, if you will, or the labor movement. And then when you look at the contract, like at UPS, that contract has literally just fallen apart. When you look at now, people are still begging for ACs in the truck. When you look at right now where the drivers who are particularly the face of the company, they've been overworked, over-disciplined, harassed. I mean, it's just a big, big mess. And there has not been an outcry from the national, right? It's one thing to believe that you negotiated a historic contract, but when the problems arise, as it is going on right now, there needs to be a response, and there is no response. And again, there is not enough of rank and file power. We have to build that because in order to take on Amazon's, the UPS's of the world, there has to be more power within the ranks. Right now, despite what they're telling you, this is a top-down organization. Brother Steve, you've been doing this longer than me. You know that the power comes from the bottom. Our members are afraid. They're afraid of their leaders. They're afraid of their employers. And that's why we're not getting anywhere. It's one thing to get wages, but what happens if I'm just getting brutalized at work? And then I turn to my leadership for help, and then they retaliate against me. There's a lot of fear within this organization, and it has to change. And that's just a crux and a little bit of why I decided to run, because I can't come to this show and speak out publicly about what Trump is doing, what UPS is doing, and then allow it in my own organization and not speak out about it, right? We can't be hypocritical. Wrong is wrong, right? And we gotta call it out. And we can't be afraid to call it out, because if you don't call it out, it's gonna continue. And we gotta move forward from this situation.
Project 2025, which was produced by the billionaires, the Heritage mm-hmm. Foundation and others, says they want to privatize all public services. And there are a large number of Teamsters in public services,
yeah.
Cities and urban areas, and wants to privatize all public education, the schools, K-12, and public colleges. Also, they want to have company unions.
Yep.
And prevent unions. First of all, it seems like the labor movement as a whole has not educated working people about this threat and the right and the threat of a fascist government that eliminates workers and workers' rights.
Exactly. And that's going to have to be one of the pillars of the campaign, is to make sure that our members are educated on not just grievances, not just panels, not just contracts, but educated on these politicians and the laws and who is with us, who's against us. And I get it. Democrats or Republicans are not, quote unquote, labor friendly. But in this season, when you have a person who is totally against your way of life, and the other group you may can get some things from, there is no other way we can do it until we get our own party. Now, we got our own party, then we can do some things. But until then, educate our members on what's really happening. I get it, you got problems with the LGBT community. I get it, you the immigrants. I get all that. But that immigrant did not do anything for you to get that contract. Didn't do anything. Didn't take it from you. Nothing. The person who is transgender is not the reason you're getting harassed at your job. Had nothing to do with it. Right. But that's what the other side has done. They have made these personal problems bigger than how you take care of your family. And that's something that we have to educate our members on.
And the attack on immigrants. I mean, immigrants built this country.
Yeah.
Along with Native Americans. There are a large number of immigrants in food service, tourism. A large number of them are immigrants. They've come to this country to work, and they're members of our unions. Has Sean O'Brien ever spoken out against the attack on immigrants? Because it seems like a large number of them, black and brown, they're immigrants and minorities in the union.
I don't think he can, nor will he, for a number of reasons. Number one, Trump is not going to allow him to speak out against anything he does, especially when it comes to workers. I mean, you saw what O'Brien did when Elon Musk was going after Trump. He came in and talking about Elon Musk's illegitimate kids. Like, dude, what are you talking? You got members in your own union who can't even get home in time to see their kids because they're being overworked and abused and harassed. And you're talking about somebody else's illegitimate kids. Why are we bringing up kids anyway? Worry about what's going on in the Teamsters, especially with all this stuff going on. But his priorities are somewhere else. Trump is pulling his strings, as you can tell. He refused to speak out against anything he does, especially when it comes to workers. And it's obvious that he has, I don't want to say he has sold his soul to the devil, because I'm not God, I can't say that. But he has sold himself and what the Teamsters are supposed to be about. He has sold that to Donald Trump.
And the issue of racism, the issue of going back to the Confederacy, they want to rename the bases after Confederates. This idea that you shouldn't talk about the Civil War and what happened in the Civil War.
Racism is alive and well. And what I found out is that the more people of color talk about it, then other races feel as though there is this reverse racism. Well, it's all black folks. We complaining about this. We complaining about that. Slavery was so far long ago. Get over. Boom, 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 boom. And we talk about these issues, especially in our union. They don't really like to bring these things up because it makes people feel uncomfortable. Well, they're supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. Racism is bad. It's wrong. We're supposed to be a union in a country that is for everybody, right? Equitable treatment, equality, right? And so when people view their race as more important than the other people, especially in the union, then you're sabotaging the movement. All of us are equal, all of us.
And hasn't race, sex, and other issues been used to pit worker against worker, pitting black worker against white worker, women against men? It seems that that's a tactic of the boss, the millionaires, the owners, to have everybody fighting each other rather than uniting as a class.
Absolutely.
To defend themselves.
That's what they want. They want us all divided on something. We have to explain to our members, don't fall for this. This is what they're going to do. When they delay, when they deny, when they talk about this, when they talk about, and especially in classifications, well, the part-timers this and the feeder drivers do that, the warehouse people over here, the grocery workers, all they're doing is just dividing the con. No, we're all members of the working class. It doesn't matter if you drive a truck in the warehouse or if you're stocking the shelves. All of us are in the same exact class. And once we realize that, that the enemy, billionaires and the employer class, the ruling class, we will be able to win. But again, education will be very, very vital into doing that.
Another important issue is the tariffs and trade war. The port of Los Angeles is down 50%, San Francisco 40%. This trade war is pitting American workers against Canadian workers, against Mexican workers. It's going to lead to loss of jobs. It's going to lead to blaming other workers. What's your view? Because not only has Sean O'Brien supported the tariffs and the trade war, but also Sean Fain of the UAW.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole economic crisis where we're blocking other countries or raising the tariffs and basically going into an economic war against other countries.
Yeah.
What does that mean to Teamsters? And
that doesn't benefit the working class at all. Whenever you can put working class people against each other, it's not going to end well for the working class. Whenever you have, again, Trump, who's a billionaire, part of that billionaire class, they're always going to revert to being a billionaire or an employer. And what they do, take advantage, get workers fighting against each other. Like you said, Canadians versus Americans, Americans versus Latinos. Why? But that's what they want. Because if you're united, they can't win, and they know that. So let's create a tariff war. Let's put these group of workers against each other, right? Let's do that, because now I'm fighting you instead of focusing on the problem, which is the employer having that much power over us. And that can happen. But the only way that we could do that is something that I'm glad you talked about earlier, is educating our members. That is going to be one of the most important pillars of what we're going to be running on. Education, participation, inclusivity, all those things. Rank and file power. That's the campaign. Rank and true rank and file power.
And one of the other issues is the question of war. The United States spends.
Yeah.
We recently had some mass demonstrations against a king, no king in America, and against oligarchy. There have been protests against Elon Musk's Tesla factory, against oligarchs, against fascism. There is a fear that people have that Trump, for example, may decide that we need martial law and we have a Reichstag incident and say that we have to have martial law, no more elections.
Yeah,
people
are
talking about an election 2 years or next year. That may not happen with Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got control of the police, the FBI, the state. What do you think about that if they try to institute martial law and prevent an election? You think there should be a general strike? You think that
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. It has to be a total shutdown of labor. Nobody getting in the trucks. Nobody getting in the warehouses. Nobody getting in the planes. Nobody is stocking the shelves at the Walmarts, grocery stores. It has to be a complete shutdown of every single thing moving. If you're a worker, you stay home. It has to be. If he does that, the response has to be, working class, we ain't showing up to do nothing. We ain't doing nothing.
And Sarah Nelson, who is the president of the airline flight attendants, AFA, in the CWA, has called for a general strike.
Yes.
When Trump took away bargaining rights for these federal workers. But it seems within the labor movement, at least the leadership of the labor movement, there's not even a discussion about that kind of action. There's no discussion about fascism and what to do about it. Are you concerned that there needs to be that debate, but there isn't really a discussion nationally among working people about what a potential danger this is?
Yeah, the conversations need to be taking place. It needs to be with every national labor organization's leader. They need to be having these conversations, and they need to be educating the members every chance they get. Through leafleting, through gating, through your union meetings, it has to be a conversation that, hey, if the Trump administration does this, this will be our response. I know you you don't like, you may think Trump is this, that, and the other, but he is going to attack your way of life. And you can like him all you want to. You can vote for him, whatever. But if you want that pension, if you want continue to get those wages and those protections at work, then when he attacks working class people, this is what needs to happen. This is our response. This is what it looks like. This is what's going to happen. And those conversations need to be taking place right now.
That was Philadelphia Teamster Local 623 Secretary Treasurer Richard Hooker Jr. on why he's running against Teamster President Sean O'Brien. That was the Paul Butterfield Band, Work Song. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. On June 26th, a national day of protest took place against the Palantir Corporation, which is owned by billionaire techno-fascist Peter Thiel. Protesters at the Palo Alto headquarters and the New York office charged that the company is profiting from the mass roundup of immigrants and fueling the genocide in Gaza by providing data and information tools to target Palestinians. Here are voices from the rally in Palo Alto.
Katie, I'm an organizer with Planet Over Profits Bay Area chapter, and the reason why we're here and why hundreds of people across the Bay Area are actually getting prepared to mobilize here right now is because we are absolutely furious at the role that Palantir is playing in powering the mass ICE abductions that are happening all across our state, within our very communities, to our neighbors, to our family members, to our friends, as well as the ongoing role that Palantir has been playing for several years at this point in the Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people. And that's not even to mention how upset people are about the fact that, as the New York Times reported over the last few weeks, that Palantir has been tapped by Donald Trump's administration, actually, to create the largest mass surveillance database in American history. And so we're here because Palantir has gotten away with their shady business for far too long. They've operated in the shadows for a long time while advancing their own private political agendas, specifically their chairman, Peter Thiel's political agendas. And so we're naming names, we're drawing connections, we're telling folks exactly what it is that they're doing, and we're telling Palantir, hell no, not in our neighborhood, not in our backyards.
These people, what kind of world do they want? Because some have said they're techno-fascist.
Yes.
They want a fascist regime here and around the world. Do you agree with that?
It's not even just that I agree with that. I think that Peter Thiel, the chairman and co-founder of Palantir, has told us exactly what kind of world he wants. Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, they've told us exactly the world that they want. And the world that they want is actually one where there is no multiculturalism. Peter Thiel wrote an entire book about it. They don't want multiculturalism. They think democracy is actually bad for America. So I think that's the world that they want to see, right? They want to see an authoritarian world, and with people who are just like them, interested in the same worldview that they have, are the ones who get to make all the shots and the rest of us fall in line like sheep. And also that is a country that is very white, right? And is like non-diverse. And we see that is exactly why they're involved in deportations.
Are they profiting from deportations?
Yes, they are absolutely profiting from deportations. So one of the biggest contracts that ICE holds is with the HSI, which is a subdivision of ICE, and it's for a project called Falcon. That project, in and of itself, has won them millions and millions of dollars in federal contracts. Altogether, actually, when you combine money between all the different agencies that they're contracted with the federal government, since the top of this year alone, so since January alone, they've received over $1 billion in government contracts. So they're absolutely profiting from this. That's not a question in my mind.
What can people do about it? Because it seems like they have control of the state now. They're working with Trump. They have state power.
Absolutely. And that's really, really scary. And I think that folks are right to feel scared. And I understand why people feel powerless. But one of the things that you can do is come out to things like this. So, and that's not just like a pipe dream of mine, right? It's not just a pipe dream that coming out to actions like this can make an actual difference. We saw the proof of that in Tesla takedown. And so really similar to Tesla takedown, what we're going to see very soon over the next couple of months, it's already gotten started, is we're going to see a wave of anti-Palantir actions all across the country that are going to be sustained disruption, sustained action, sustained community building, sustained political education. And we are going to aim to tank Palantir, permanently damage their reputation, and elevate them to such a level in the public eye that they will not be able to continue their work in the shadows exactly the same way that we did with Tesla. A lot of the folks who organize this are actually key organizers of the Tesla takedown movement. So we know we can win. We know we can win powerful concessions. We know we can beat back power. We know we can cause them to lose money. So if you want to get involved in this fight, come out to one of these. There is going to be one near you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My name is Hadia Matin-Rad. I'm a healthcare worker. I'm a physician. And I'm with Healthcare Workers for Palestine Bay Area. As a healthcare worker, I work in palliative medicine. And one of the things we do in palliative medicine is to try to alleviate suffering. Palantir is doing the exact opposite. They are causing unnecessary suffering by assisting in deportations, by assisting in AI technology that is targeting Palestinians, allowing the Israeli government and the US government to starve children to death. That could not be farther from prevention of suffering, which is what healthcare workers try to do, let alone, you know, try to like save life, right? And so I think that we, like, that is just like what they're doing already, and that as healthcare workers, it is a moral imperative that we stand up against that. And as working class people all across healthcare, across all different sectors of our work, to say like we cannot have this. This is bad for all of us, regardless of immigration status, regardless of nationality, all the different identities that we hold. This is not good for any of us. And they, you know, there's the whole like poem of like, first they came for the communists and they stayed silent, right? Like that's the same thing. First they're coming for our undocumented neighbors. Next thing it's gonna be me and you.
And they're spending trillions of dollars on war. Billions and bombing, and yet people in this country can't get health care. Mm-hmm. They're attacking Medicaid, they're privatizing Medicare. It seems that these people really don't care about the fact that people even in this country can't get health care while they're spending trillions for war.
That's right. You've said it all. You know, like, why is it that my patients are not getting their cancer screening, and we're seeing them when they're in late stage cancers, when I'm the person who tries to just help alleviate their suffering as they die? That is not right. And in a country that is spending so much money on militarization, on policing, on the prison industrial complex, like this is completely morally bankrupt, and we can do better. My patients, myself, all of us can be receiving healthcare that we need. We just need to put, they don't care. The Trump administration, Palantir, all these, you know, tech billionaires, they do not actually care about people.
Those were the voices protesting the Palantir Corporation, which is supporting the Trump government and making billions of dollars collecting data and using it for both Israeli government and ICE operations.
freedom, I'd meet him. Where'd you read him? This one needs a brand new weed em. Weed and the key. Weed and the key into life. Let's beat em. Weed em smartphones, don't beat em.
MIA, Borders. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal spoke to Judge Andrew Napolitano on his Judging Freedom podcast on Wednesday, June 25th, about the Iranian-Israeli-American war. 12 days after Israel's decapitation strikes targeted Iranian military, intelligence, political leadership, and facilities, followed by American B-2 bombers dropping 15-ton bunker buster bombs on Iranian nuclear research and production sites, a tenuous ceasefire is barely holding. Stories emerging from Israel speak of heavy losses to Israeli leadership and command structures. Blumenthal comments on the varying aims of the warring states as well as the potential impacts of the conflict on Israeli society, while seeing the war as a potential watershed event for Israel.
Trump sought to convince Americans and his base that they were destroying Iran's nuclear program in a Top Gun style operation with the porn-themed name Midnight Hammer, and it's turned out to be Operation Midnight Scammer, as what Iran even told us days before, which is that it had moved its enriched uranium stockpile out of Fordo, has turned out to be confirmed by a Defense Intelligence Agency assessment, along with other intelligence officials who are blowing the whistle on this scam, as well as Israeli pundits speaking in broad daylight on Israeli networks, that this was just simply symbolic strike by Trump giving in to Israeli manipulation, which was designed to draw the US into a much larger regime change theater. And I heard that from a Trump official, an insider, who was familiar with a lot of these discussions on how Trump was manipulated almost exclusively through the Mossad and Israeli briefers pushing weapons of mass destruction deceptions that would be laughed at by the American public, which were laughed at, which is why Donald Trump didn't even bother making the case to Americans, as George W. Bush did on Iraq, that the smoking gun could soon become a mushroom cloud. And so now nobody believes him except for the biggest Trump cultists and even the intellectual architects of America First, like Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon, have accused Trump of betraying their principles and are portraying him as a kind of Orange McCain.
You are quite right, Max. There was no serious effort to persuade the American people because there was no evidentiary basis with which to make that case.
There were actually Mossad briefers in the Oval Office, in the briefing room. This is public. It was well known, but not very, didn't receive enough focus, that Mossad director David Barnea and Ron Dermer, whose father was the mayor of Miami Beach and is basically an American Israel lobbyist who went to work for Netanyahu, had been quote unquote briefing the president and pushing him. And they nearly pushed him to do some version of this strike back in April. That's when Mike Waltz was fired for secretly coordinating with Netanyahu. So this is well known. But what I got from a Trump official was that they were telling Trump that Iran had not only had like a nuclear stockpile that could become a nuclear weapon in a matter of weeks, but that within 1 week, it would provide a nuclear warhead to the Yemeni Houthis, which is just absolutely laughable. The Trump official described the briefers as completely tactless, hyper-aggressive, fear-mongering, and the person that it worked on best was someone who is the Israel lobby, which is basically an arm of Israeli intelligence in the United States, AIPAC, had cultivated since the beginning of his career. In April at the Gray Zone, and I think we discussed this here, AIPAC's new CEO, Elliot Brandt, described how his organization had groomed John Ratcliffe since he was a congressman coming out of Dallas, the Dallas area. Who is John Ratcliffe? He has no background in intelligence, no background in the military, was a small town lawyer who became mayor of a town of 7,000 outside Dallas called Heath. Then got elected to Congress, became funded by AIPAC with, you know, Israel lobby money, and then emerges as one of Donald Trump's most loyal defenders. Donald Trump nominates him for director of national intelligence simply because he wants a loyalist there. Doesn't care about his background or that he was just a backbencher nobody. And John Ratcliffe's nomination initially fails because he lied about taking a lead role on one of the most politicized terrorism cases in American history against the Holy Land Foundation, a case which was managed by Israel's Mossad to the point where the Mossad actually sent one of its agents into the courtroom. The courtroom had to be cleared, and these Palestinian American defendants were subjected to dodgy dossiers claiming that they were at the nexus of a Hamas funding terrorist network, and they were all given life sentences. Completely phony trial. But Ratcliffe lied about being in that case. He eventually made it to DNI a year later. Then when Trump won again, he was appointed CIA director, and John Ratcliffe has since become the key channel from Mossad director David Barnea in delivering Donald Trump phony Israeli intelligence briefings, claiming that Iran's nuclear stockpile was going to turn into a weapon in a week, and that Trump could immediately eliminate it with this Top Gun style strike. So John Ratcliffe was referred to me by this Trump official as Mossad's stenographer. And now look at what Donald Trump is about to do. Now that his whole case has collapsed about blowing up the Fordo bunker, he is going to release more Israeli intelligence to counter his own U.S. intelligence officials in the Pentagon. That's what Donald Trump is going to do to save his hide.
Did Netanyahu cry uncle? Did he recognize the devastation that the Iranians had caused and how he and Mossad and the IDF had underestimated? Some of them have said this publicly. I think Ben-Gavir may have, how they underestimated the strength of Iran. Did they call up Trump and say, you got to get us out of this mess that we started?
Well, first of all, in Trump's comments, that's the most daylight I've ever seen between the U.S. and Israel after Trump does what Israel wants. You know, Bill Clinton privately complained. Every president has hated Benjamin Netanyahu. Bill Clinton privately stormed out of a meeting with him and said, you know, who's the effing superpower here?
Right.
Donald Trump's saying it openly. He's like, we're the superpower. What is this small little foreign country doing trying to interrupt my diplomacy? And Steve Bannon is saying,
assume when he says things critical of Netanyahu or Israel, that it's a stunt. It's a deception.
Well, he's trying to recover his dignity because he's under fire from his former chief of staff, Steve Bannon. And it was Steve Bannon who actually said in his latest War Room broadcast that Israel needed the ceasefire, that Israel was threatened, that Israel was weak. And Israel thought Netanyahu was under the delusion that after assassinating Nasrallah, forcing a ceasefire with Hezbollah, after regime change in Syria, 2 months after that, 3 months after that, that he could turn his attention to Iran and put Gaza on the back burner and just let the genocide simmer, and that he could score this devastating blow that would lead the U.S. into eliminating Iran's nuclear program. That has failed. In the first day of Israel's assault on Iran, Friday the 13th, it looked like Iran was completely unprepared, that they were stunned, and that they would not even be able to respond. Hours later, over 100 ballistic missiles descended on Israel and penetrated the Iron Dome, the Arrow, the multi-billion dollar THAAD system, and U.S. destroyers were trying to knock down ballistic missiles. They couldn't do it. And with that, Israel's colonial psyche was penetrated. And this continued day after day, Israelis experiencing some version of what Gaza had been experiencing for the first time. They had to choose between possibly being buried under the rubble or sweaty night after night in the shelters. And this really has shaken Netanyahu. And meanwhile, in Gaza, because Israel had concentrated so much focus on Iran, is the Israeli military has been on the run. Western media isn't paying attention to this, but in Khan Yunis, Israeli military has been taking bodies day after day. Yesterday, they lost 7 soldiers in one incident. Netanyahu proclaimed that would defeat Hamas by April 2024. He proclaimed that he would achieve total victory. He's put the hostage deal on the back burner. And they're still losing many soldiers in Gaza. Hamas is still intact. And they are now claiming that they can defeat a regional power like Iran. So I think Israel has been kind of exposed here. And it all goes back to the theory that Hassan Nasrallah introduced after Hezbollah kicked the Israeli occupation army out of southern Lebanon in 2000, which is the spiderweb theory, which holds that because of the colonial nature of Jewish Israeli society, if it faces enough military pressure for enough time, that society will begin putting pressure on their military intelligence elite and their leadership to make serious political concessions. And so Israel is doing everything possible militarily to avoid the core political concessions that will be necessary to secure its survival. And one of those things that it thinks it can do is to continue to manipulate the U.S. into saving and protecting it. But the American public has less appetite than ever, whether it's what we saw from Rouhani and Thomas Massey teaming up on the War Powers Resolution, what we see from the podcasters on the right like Theo Vaughn and Candace Owens, or Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson in America First, or on the left with the election of Zohran Mamdani, a 33-year-old assembly member and influencer who has called for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu if he ever visits New York. Israel has lost the American public. Jewish Israeli society was semi-functional from what I understood from people I know there throughout the war. And it would sort of shut down around 6 p.m. and restaurants would stop delivering. People would go to their safe rooms in their house or their bunkers. Now it's open again. What we don't see in Israel is victory celebrations. There is no great victory. Jewish Israelis have been at war for over 20 months now. They're increasingly exhausted. The reservist corps is depleted. Israel's economy is suffering. It would cost over $300 million a night to maintain this war, to keep up the air defenses, the interceptors, which were being depleted. And Israel's due for another credit downgrade, a major tech hub or tech center in Beersheba was struck. The Microsoft offices were hit by a ballistic missile. And this tech sector relies so much on foreign direct investment. And foreign direct investment relies on Israel's air defenses to maintain a stable environment. So we're going to see a weakening of Israel's middle class. And I was reading an article in an Israeli economic publication, Calculist, which said that some of the major Israeli innovations to come are better bomb shelters for the population, along with better surveillance tech. So that's not a place that I think a lot of people want to live, especially Jews in the so-called diaspora aren't going to want to move there. So the future looks increasingly dystopian and dark for Israeli society. And again, their military leadership has said that there is no ceasefire and that they will seek to reignite this war. What does that mean for people living in Israel who have basically become fodder for Netanyahu's total victory? The future is not bright. As Theodore Herzl said, but from a completely different angle, it is no dream.
What damage did Netanyahu do to himself by starting this war, never expecting the retaliation that he induced?
We're going to see a political upheaval in Israel after Netanyahu leaves the scene. And I think it will lead to another spider web like situation, but more intense, but one that resembled what we saw before October 7th in Israel, where Netanyahu was facing this full on kind of almost civil war over judicial reform. And it became sort of a war between the right wing messianist camp and the Likud camp that supported Netanyahu and the enlightened public, what was left of the center and center left and the Ashkenazi elite. And you had reservists refusing to show up for duty, including Air Force reservists, which was a significant role in weakening Israel and opening the door for an operation like Al-Aqsa flood on October 7th. Israel was at a very weak point by October 7th, but the shock and casualties of October 7th brought Jewish Israelis from all different sectors to rally around the flag momentarily. That's all gone now. Netanyahu doesn't have any of that goodwill left, and Israel is set for a major political upheaval as soon as Netanyahu's coalition cracks. But what Netanyahu has failed to do is achieve the greatest objective of his life, which is to bring about regime change in Iran. And this is something we haven't talked about because we focus mostly on the nuclear issue. Okay, the Defense Intelligence Agency has leaked this document showing that at best the U.S. set back Iran's nuclear program by a few months. So that was a failure. But what Israel has done by initiating this war and killing over 600 Iranians, almost mostly civilians, is set back the regime change plan possibly decades. There has been a huge rally around the flag effect in Iran. Everyone I met while I was in Iran is now telling me that people who have deep grievances with the government supported the war, were out in the streets chanting for the war. And Iranians have come together. They feel like it's another revolutionary moment. The hybrid weapons of Western and Israeli regime change, channels like Iran International, BBC, Persia, the Western media, are totally discredited inside Iran right now. And so Netanyahu has achieved that. And then finally, in the US, Netanyahu has achieved the disdain of a part of the American public that he always counted on as the most reliable part of his base, which is Republicans. Mm. According to a new CNN poll, only 20% of Republicans under the age of 45 were enthusiastic about Trump's strike. And, you know, wow. Look at what their influencers are saying. They're just disgusted with the whole thing. So politically and psychologically, Iran has won this round. And Israel, it's a self-inflicted blow by Israel.
That was Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal speaking on the podcast Judging Freedom on June 25th. The Gray Zone website is thegrayzone.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Anne Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.